You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
A few months ago, you might have been able to walk through Madrid with a Catalan flag wrapped around you. I wouldn't advise doing that now because emotions are running very high.
Tim Marshall there speaking to us earlier on the briefing as Madrid prepares to remind Barcelona who's in charge. My guests Tom Edwards, Chris Lord and Andrew Tuck will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Thailand's preparations for a royal funeral, the growing problem of cutesy public service announcements, and the worst idea in the history of theatre, which is a pretty high bar. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle 24's executive producer Tom Edwards, Monocle Magazine's features editor Chris Lord, and its editor Andrew Tuck. Welcome all. And we will start in Thailand, which has one more weekend to prepare for next weekend's funeral, funeral of King Bhumibol Adulyadej, the late king who was the world's longest-serving monarch when he died a little over a year ago, aged 88, will be cremated in a custom-built structure of golden pavilions near the Grand Palace in Bangkok, details of which include statues of the king's favourite pet dogs, one of which the king wrote an inevitably best-selling book about. The funeral observances will last 5 days and cost somewhere in the vicinity of $90 million. Andrew, first of all, there's been a certain amount of suggestion that this is all a bit much, especially for a relatively poor country, but it's not really any more or less, is it, than what most countries would put on for a long-serving monarch.
Oh, I think it's a little bit more.
It's different, but you know, when the day comes in this country when it next has to inter a monarch, that's going to be quite a production as well. It'll cost more than 90 million.
I'm sure it'll cost more than 90 million, but what's interesting is that in many Asian countries that idea of the collective thing, of doing things in unison, of acting in the same way, of showing respect, is so much more deeply ingrained. It's not that people have been, you know, people have been told kind of what to do. People also want to act in unison. So I was there passing through only a week ago, and I was there was another day of mourning call because it was exactly the day that he had died.
October 13th.
Yeah,
I think.
There was a die, and so they had 89 seconds of silence in the afternoon because he was 89 years old when he died. But we happened to be in a very large shopping mall when that time was approaching. And in the 30, 40 minutes in the run-up to that, there was a band outside playing quite nice music. And then suddenly all of the people in the stores went outside, all the store staff. They stood up outside, not just in some ramshackle way. They were organized by their managers into very neat lines. They bowed their heads just before the moment of silence. And then actually during the silence, they fell to the floor, and there's a way of, it's not kneeling, you prostrate yourself to one side. So every member of staff, from the highest manager to the young guy off the perfume counter, was suddenly lying in a neat row, absolute silence. Every single person dressed in black, and we had gone up on the walkway above to watch the whole ceremony, and it was kind of amazing because nobody was tittering, nobody was not joining in. It was absolutely in unison. And I think when you went around the city, you were struck by the fact that people were kind of at the edges, having fun and doing all their things, but it has affected the city. Every single building you go past has a sign of remembrance up. Many of the building sites are completely wrapped in awnings that have vast pictures of him throughout all of his life, celebrating him almost as a film star. And this has gone on for 1 year. It's had, no doubt, had an impact on the economy. And one other last tiny thing, when we were in one of these department stores, we were about to leave, and I just kind of looked around, and I suddenly realised the job of the buyer for men's fashion, for example, had been reduced to just looking through the catalogues and picking everything in grey and black, because there was a Ralph Lauren concession. It was nothing. There were no pink polos or bright green polos. It was grey, black, grey, black, grey, black. And that is, I think, kind of unprecedented. I don't think you will see that here when the Queen dies.
Chris, most of the reporting on the Thai monarchy outside Thailand, in recent years at least, has been through the prism of the country's extremely hardcore laws on lèse majesté, which has seen several people, including foreigners, sent down for quite long terms for really quite, well, what appear somewhat frivolous offences. There's at least one case of somebody being charged for making fun of one of the dogs that is being immortalised in the pavilions. Is that respect among Thais, as far as it's possible to tell, has it been for the man, or is it for the institution?
So I think, to build on what Andrew was saying there about how ingrained it is in day-to-day society, I think one thing, I was in Thailand towards the start of the year, so it wasn't that long after he died. I remember you get to the immigration counter and there's a big sign when you get there that says, Thailand encourages you during your stay to not wear loud shirts because of the events that have happened here. Stick to black, stick to grey, as Andrew mentioned. I think we have to understand a little bit on one side of this question. I think there's one side, which is that the king and the monarchy there, Thailand is a country that was never colonised per se. It was never conquered. It was never become absorbed into any other empire. It was always its own thing. And I think that the monarchy, for a lot of people there, in some ways a bit like what it is for here in the UK, it is a sort of its own Shinto. It's like this thing that everybody buys into as a kind of way to maintain the idea of Thailand's continuity. Even, you know, it is something that does touch people, and they see it as a sort of ritualised way to continue the country a little bit. But on the other side of the equation, what I think has happened, if you look at the numbers, since the military junta has came to power, there's been 82 people have fell foul of that lèse majesté.
It has been stepped up noticeably.
Absolutely. And it's been stepped up because it's become quite convenient for the junta to use those lèse majesté laws to create a culture of subservience to the situation. And you mentioned sort of criticising the dog of the king was something that people got in trouble for. But also another guy was jailed for 6 years for liking a Facebook article, an article on Facebook that happened to be, you know, negatively mentioning the dog. So there's this idea of lèse majesté that's been dragged so out of the realms of what it used to mean by the junta that we have to see that this reporting, and you're right, that is how it's viewed quite often, but it's because it's changed so phenomenally in the last few years because it's convenient to the junta.
Can I say one thing I think that's interesting about this is this idea of change. I wonder whether any long-serving monarchs, be it Bhumibol or our own Queen Elizabeth, it almost does a disservice to their own office by being incumbent for such a long time, because the role, its surrounding pomp and circumstance and place in the social structure doesn't adapt as society has adapted. You know, you look at Queen Elizabeth, if you came to power in Britain or the United Kingdom in the 50s and you're still there, what, 60, 70 years later, unbelievable social change has unfolded, but the office, because you have come to represent it, you're the personification of it, it doesn't change. In some ways, I think the many heads of state or royal houses would be better served by having time-limited periods of service, because then their role and the structure surrounding it might have to change. I mean, to reflect social changes.
We have seen some voluntary abdications in recent years. In the Netherlands, they seem to sort of realise that it's not advisable to stick around. Are you suggesting that that the actual monarchy can become the victim of one monarch's success,
well,
as it were?
I think possibly, and it'll be interesting to see. We know that, for example, in this country, you know, Charles is very unpopular, and I think there'll be a very different, there'll be a shift, profound shift in public opinion of what the monarchy represents, the role it plays in what is, after all, supposed to be a parliamentary democracy. And I wonder, the name escapes me, but Bhumibol's successor, you know, again, they're going to have...
Vajira Longkorn.
...is going to have to contend with a public that maybe is going to scrutinise lèse majesté laws in a very different way than they would have done previously.
I think, though, but on that point, though, Tom, I think exactly what people go to that monarchy for is its conservatism. I mean, if you look at the new guy who's coming in, he's got motorcycle gang tattoos. He lives most of the year in Munich and is famous for his shopping sprees and quite often wears cut-off jeans. But as soon as he came into...
Not the cut-off jeans. That's really the last straw.
But as soon as he came in back into the public eye again, as it preparing for the coronation, what did they immediately do? Put him in the traditional robes. People buy into that conservatism as that Shinto that I was talking about
before. If he's a motorcycle...
I don't think people want sustainability.
I'm not sure. I think we say we don't want sustainability, but what was interesting is, you know, after the death of Princess Diana here, we had this notion that we were on the edge, on the cusp of becoming a republic. But actually, in no time at all, it only required a few anniversaries connected to the Queen's reign, and people snapped back in. And I think that is because we're very aware that, you know, our politicians are a mainly useless bunch, that society does change very quickly, and that you need one or two threads that run through society. And I think that people have got cautious about tugging out that thread of the Queen, because they think that actually it does stitch together all sorts of things. And I think that's the same here. You have a society that has been riven by, as we say, currently a military regime, you know, fierce standoffs between political parties, a Muslim insurgency. So you want something at the heart of that, that you hunker around and you protect, maybe in an extraordinary way. But I think also for the Thais, it feels almost like, you know, maybe, you know, a Muslim, you know, blaspheming or something, taking the name of Muhammad in the wrong way, for example, is he's almost seen as a deity. And that's why that they react so strongly. So if you go to the cinema and they play the national anthem, you damn well stand up.
Well, let's take a look now at Spain, the government of which will meet tomorrow to discuss the implementation of direct rule over Catalonia. It's being reported this afternoon that Spain's conservative government and Spain's socialist opposition have agreed to hold new regional elections in Catalonia in January. In the meantime, Catalonia's president, Carles Puigdemont, continues to hint slash threaten that he will utter the Declaration of Independence, from which he has thus far restrained himself. Chris, would they be trying to pitch January elections as a sort of official referendum on independence in the hope that anti-independence parties somehow win?
I think, regardless of how January goes now, I think that the fundamental issue that we're all sort of facing this weekend is what happens now. I mean, this decision is going to have to be made by the central government to reinstate some direct rule there. And I think, you know, I think even the talk of a sort of January election is a little bit preemptive. The thing hasn't been decided yet. I mean, Puigdemont can still declare independence. They can still declare direct rule. So therefore, I think this what you're talking about here, this reports of the conservative government and the socialist opposition agreeing to these elections, is a little bit of theatre, I think, to sort of suggest that it's still, you know, there is some continuity beyond this weekend.
Tom, is the Spanish government betting here on the hope that a dose of economic reality might have cooled off the atavistic nationalist sentiment? I mean, we have seen, you know, since the referendum was held, we've seen the EU make it fairly clear that Catalonia would be out on its own with little prospect of readmission. Lots of major employers in Catalonia have said that as a consequence of that, they would pack up and push off.
I think that's probably a hope that many people have. I don't know if it's going to work here. And we've seen, you know, if you make a parallel clumsily with, say, the Brexit vote in this country, plenty of people said, look, there's punishing economic realities around the corner, and it didn't change.
Lots of people didn't care.
Who were locked into their predetermined pattern of behaviour. We've seen banks leaving Barcelona for Seville and so on. I'm not sure. I think one of the problems here, and again to draw another parallel, which actually Andrew made just before we came on air about Brexit, it's that you've got politicians who, I guess you could generously say, were burying their heads in the sand, and if you were being more critical yet, were willfully neglecting to address a profound, almost existential question that their country was facing, in the hope that what? It would just go away. Now, it's all well and good for the courts, the Castilian courts, to say, well, this vote was not legal, or that actually all of the pro-Spain voters in Catalonia boycotted it unofficially or officially, so therefore it wasn't representative anyway. But the problem, I think, as Chris rightly identifies, is that this has become the sole issue, certainly for the Catalans. And yeah, I agree. I think the January votes will be probably shambolic. And there's a much more immediate problem, which is that if direct rule is imposed, we haven't really seen devolved powers being taken back very often. There's been a threat of that. We've even had that in the United Kingdom to a degree. But we've not seen an obvious threat. And it's very hard at this stage to see that anything other than a really violent and, you know, an incendiary situation resulting when that does happen.
Andrew, the invocation of Article 155 of the Spanish Constitution would effectively dissolve Catalonia's government. What would be a smart response from them?
Well, what's been fascinating over the last few days is What you don't want to be is the person holding the lead, as it were, holding the ball that makes you want to make the next judgment. So when it was the central government in Madrid saying, come on, Puigdemont, what do you want? We're going to sit back and have a nice week up here in Madrid. Let us know what you want. Rajoy seemed in a very strong position because, you know, he wasn't doing anything wrong. It was up to Puigdemont to actually play his card and say, we'll go for independence. But now the game has changed a little bit. Actually, Puigdemont doesn't have to kind of reveal too much. And the Madrid government risks being seen doing a larger scale what it did when it policed that vote and being seen as heavy-handed and coming in and trying to push its agenda.
Do you think they've learnt that lesson, though? Because that did play incredibly badly for them. They did certainly had the law on their side in that the referendum was, by any, you know, straightforward reading of the law, illegal, but they did react foolishly.
Yeah, but the only trouble is that if you are really going to impose rule from Madrid, the only thing to do is send in people to take over ministries and departments and be in charge of things. You can withhold funds, you can restrict transport, you can revoke licenses, all sorts of things, but that would be seen as counterproductive as well. I don't think that Rajoy really wants to kind of invoke that rule, and I think that Puigdemont doesn't really want to go for independence. So in the end, I think you have to have two people come together. And as we said, you know, the economic impact is already being felt. You know, businesses saying they're going to move. But the only funny thing is, you know, that I see that today that they've said that the tourism numbers are down 15%, that some of the big cruise ships have said they're not going to dock in Barcelona, they'll rather go to Valencia, thank you very much. But actually, we did a story in the summer. Ada Colau, the mayor of Barcelona, has been doing her damnedest to curtail tourism anyway, because I think we've got too many people. So in a marvelous way, they've solved that problem already. That's one thing, one tick.
Well, in much the same way that, you know, the large-scale immigration to Britain has been cured by tanking the economy. It's a completely brilliant plan.
It was a masterstroke after all.
We are going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Andrew Tuck, Tom Edwards and Chris Lord. Coming up next, a discussion of wacky, cute and or zany public service announcements, because this sea is what public service announcements should be like. Terse, informative and delivered with calm authority.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Andrew Tuck, Tom Edwards and Chris Lord. Now, at the risk of prejudicing the ensuing discussion, we and all reasonable, decent people can surely agree that there are few ghastlier plagues on modern life than the self-consciously cutesy public service announcement. The latest such monstrosity is being perpetrated upon commuters of the Los Angeles Metro, this is serious, who are being subjected to the urgings of a Japanese pop singer superhero called Superkind, who aims to communicate lessons on etiquette via her struggles with a furry orange monster called Rude Dude. Japan itself, not to be outdone, has been distributing leaflets on how to respond to North Korean missile attacks in the style of manga comics. We do have a clip of the Los Angelian thing. We are not making it up. This is what it's actually like.
Superkindの交通機関案内.
Taking the LA Metro downtown. It's been a long day.
Tom Edwards, what fresh hell is this?
Listen, it's got people talking. if that is the only...
It's got people screaming and holding their throbbing temples as well.
Yeah, I must say, it seemed a little out of date. I mean, there was quite a lot of stuff we had on British TV in the sort of late 90s that was appropriating this sort of particular sort of ethos from the Japanese broadcast media. It seemed a little outdated. It's certainly rather irritating. But I don't know, to go back to the way you introduced the item, Andrew, you know, does it work to sort of sternly remind people about their social responsibilities. I mean, perhaps whether it's nudged by a chuckle or nudged because they're, I don't know, trying to avoid seeing this message again.
Why are we assuming, and I'll put this to you, Andrew Tuck, why are we assuming that everybody's 8 years old?
Well, most people are in their mentality, actually. So,
oh, there we go.
Irritating.
That was Andrew
Tuck. Old-fashioned. No wonder I like it. I adore it. I think it's great. I don't think I'd want to see it more than once. That's the problem with these things. I find it super amusing once. So it's ridiculously camp. And again, no surprise that I like it. And the guy who calls it, he's called Mike Dahlquist. But even he's got a drag name. He's known as Mike Diva, a video maker. And Rude Dude is glorious. He's like the old honey monster. He's like this huge beast. So there's one about Don't Block the Aisles where he's like on his bicycle and refusing to move. And then she zaps him and destroys the bike. There's another one when he's eating on the subway and she gets her revenge. I like the fact she's quite violent in the end. She kind of destroys the bike. So all of it, I think, is like, and I also just love that people are going to be absolutely confused. But the trouble is, a joke only works once, and it's funny once. And it's the same when you're currently on British Airways. They have this for comedy relief, whatever it's called here in the UK. They have like every famous person you can imagine in the safety video. And the first time you kind of slightly engage with, and you find yourself actually watching the safety video for the first time in 30 years. And then actually by now you think, oh God, not this thing again. Because to do it with like actors, it takes five times as long as the old one.
Chris, maybe it is just me. I don't like corporations, services, things trying to be my mate.
It's not just you, Andrew. I fully agree with you.
Yeah, to hear it.
I think I agree with what Andrew's saying, which is that I think, first of all, yeah, it definitely these things only have generally quite a short shelf life, and then they become deeply irritating. But what I do also think is happening nowadays, I think there's far too much illustration around. I genuinely think there's like way too much illustration. Like I was in Singapore. You get on Singapore, there's like a whole cast of characters telling you what you should and shouldn't do on the thing, and they're cutesy little circles with names like Stand Up Stacey and Bag Down Benny and all this kind of thing.
I am never going to Singapore.
I genuinely think, like, if I walk out that door now, I sort of think, you know, you'll see so much illustration on the way to the tube. There'll be a little character telling you to do this, there'll be a little character telling you to do that, you'll go past a shop and that'll be all illustrated with little characters. I think there's too much of it. That's why I quite like sober Switzerland. Like, when you go to Switzerland, there's just none of that stuff around. Like, I think, you know, a stern sign never did anyone wrong.
God, I hope you two don't end up in the same old pensioner's home.
You're like the grumpiest
old man already.
It's horrendous. It's like when you these creatures do inhabit the London Underground. You get the tube driver who thinks he's a comedian and keeps trying to tell you other than beyond just imparting information that is actually useful, wants to say something cute or funny, which never is.
No, I think the tube thing has got a little bit out of hand. It's the same. I don't want to hear a pilot making a joke when you're landing as well, because it doesn't quite feel right. But when was the last time you actually laughed at them at something, Andrew? It's like it's amusing. It's meant to titillate you. It's like a David LaChapelle photo.
Have you met Andrew Miller before?
Can I just say that with your shirt collection, you shouldn't go to Thailand for a very long time.
We will move along from this before my sartorial sense gets deconstructed any
further. There's quite a few countries you shouldn't go to for a long time.
Probably quite a few I'm not allowed to. But finally tonight, if there is anything worse than humorous public service communications, it is immersive theatre. Seriously, actors, just act and leave us alone. Even by those standards, however, a production threatened by London company Zebedee Productions sounds especially horrific. It is, it says here, a Cockney nativity play. 55 quid a ticket. It promises a cast of East London stereotypes performing in what gives every impression of a masterclass in leaden witlessness in inevitably a pub in Hackney. Tom, have you bought your tickets?
I haven't bought my tickets just yet, but I do. I'm from proper East End stock, back a generation, sure. So I feel I can speak with some additional
authority. Do you feel as if your people are being insulted here?
Not really. I think the difficulty here is, you know, if you view theatre as part of a whole breadth of, you know, media offerings, look at the soap operas. And these are the same the world over. Obviously, we have EastEnders in this country, which, in case people don't know, is a fairly unrealistic portrait of an East London square characterised by all sorts of, you know,
it's basically half an hour,
allegorical figures.
It's basically half an hour of people shouting leave it out at each other,
right,
isn't
but
it?
But that's been on for 25, 30 years. Everybody knows it's not a realistic slice of life. And actually, if you went to that very square in East London, you would find lots of people probably like myself who are, you know, driving up house prices and driving like the real people out. And lots of people who don't even speak English. You know, most of the schools in that area around what is supposed to be
Walford. I was
going
to say that's
70% English as a second language.
That's what's so weird about this thing is that if you go to Brick Lane, it's a huge Bangladeshi community around there. They haven't dared put a Bangladeshi person, because you can't laugh at anything other than white working class people, or you can't be amused by their antics. You can't stereotype anybody who isn't white and poor. So that's where the offensive bit, in a way, is. You know, if they should have make it properly East End and like have, you know, all the kind of the gay guys going down to, you know, East Block, and they should have all the hipsters there who are kind of in the square. That's the proper
the Australian journalists who live in Leytonstone.
Yeah, all of you mob. So that could have been just as amusing. What's funny is that they have to rip it or strip it back rather to stereotypes which probably inhabited, you know, in the time of the craze in the 60s or something. That is what they're trying to get to. But it is funny, that packaging of the East End, because the other thing is that happens all the time is these Jack the Ripper tours and going to a pub to kind of experience what, you know, where Jack the Ripper went. Well, let's remember, he was, you know, a man who raped and murdered women, and now you're meant to go out for kind of a nice evening and kind of celebrate, you know, his world in a strange way. We've always packaged up the East End in fantastical and not very nice ways.
Chris, is this the British equivalent of the similar phenomenon which surrounds the south of the United States? It's the last part of, or the last American people you can still make fun of are poor white people from the south.
Yeah, I think that is true. And I think also as well, like these guys were saying, I think that the idea, this is almost a museum of something that's disappeared. Like this East End world has gone away completely. And in fact, the bit I find sort of quite distasteful about the whole thing is just like how, you know, you've got a pregnant woman drinking, there's all fighting, people in tracksuits. Yeah, these, you know, I genuinely think that it is a problem in this country. I mean, I come from a part of this country where that's quite regularly lampooned for very
in this office, even
not least in this office.
And I think you know, I do think it is a thing in this country where, and Andrew is right. It's like, you know, to talk about the actual real East End nowadays would be viewed as racist or otherwise. So therefore, there becomes a sector of society that we can use to mock. I don't know. I found it terrible, and I think the sad part of it is what the East End as well has become, because it is such a place of gentrification. It is such a place.
But I think
of
that's what
people
are objecting to here, is not merely the mocking of the stereotypes, but the fact that it appears to be middle class people not being content with having driven these people from the neighbourhood, now making fun of them once they've left.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, I think there is something a bit distasteful about that, and I think you know, not to be sort of too down on it, because you know. I'm sure that wasn't the intention of the people to go out there and offend a certain class of society. But I genuinely think it amazes me that it would be, with all the conversations that we're having in our time about inclusiveness, about making sure that we don't look down our nose at people for certain things, that we would then have a comedy like this that's so brazen. And I do wonder if that's possibly their thinking, that it was so brazen and so offensive that they sort of went beyond the realms of offence, as it were.
Andrew, have they just failed to ask that always useful question, what could possibly go wrong?
Well, I'm sure they started out with a good intention. They just thought it was quite amusing to kind of make some money by setting up something. And the price thing doesn't really worry me too much. You go and see, I don't know, a theatre production about, you know, poverty in Africa up at Tricycle Theatre in London, you'll pay 55 quid for your ticket. That's just the nature of theatre and what it costs. And I think that isn't the balking thing. As we said, it's just... is a little bit kind of distasteful, picking on the same kind of poor stereotypes yet again.
Well, see you all down the front. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Tom Edwards, Chris Lord and Andrew Tuck, thank you for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Henry Ree Sheridan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Katie Watkins. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next, 1900. Marcus Hippie is in with the menu. I'm back with more on the day's big stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at this time on Monday at 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.